You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Early this morning, Vice President Mike Pence formally declared Joe Biden as our next president.
The announcement of the state of the vote by the President of the Senate shall be deemed a sufficient declaration of the persons elected President and Vice President of the United States, each for the term beginning on the 20th day of January 2021, and shall be entered together with the list of the votes on the journals of the Senate and the House of Representatives.
How do you feel after Trump loyalists stormed the Capitol? How do you feel about members of Congress who objected to certifying Biden's victory, including Representatives Tom Tiffany and Scott Fitzgerald? It's 800-642-1234. Andra Gillespie is an associate professor of political science at Emory University in Atlanta and a political analyst. Andra, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Well, help us find some clarity this morning. What is on your mind about what happened?
This confirms, I think, many people's fears about the stability of our democracy. In general, I am confident, that the republic will survive. But we've seen really deep fissures, and it's going to take time to heal them. It's going to take time to really help bring the country back together and to fix the breaches and fix holes that had long been there that we didn't realize were there before. While there were some moments where it looked like some of the fever broke in terms of our national division, those divisions are still there, and there's still people who are happy to kind of, make the cleaves even deeper and wider. So I think we still have a long way to go, and we got a real sobering sort of view of who we are as a country yesterday.
President Trump tweeted through his aide early this morning that there will be a peaceful transfer of power, but the American people are beginning to wonder, what does that look like?
I don't know what that looks like. I think what it looks like, what President Trump was acknowledging in that tweet was that as of noon on January 20th, he is not going to be president of the United States anymore. The big issue is that he still concedes that he won the election, and I think he's still going to disseminate conspiracy theories that suggest that he won, even though he knows that he's lost all legal options to try to pursue a challenge. And yesterday was the culmination of him whipping up a frenzy of people in support of him who didn't realize that yesterday's challenge in Congress was only going to be ceremonial. They were going to register their concerns. They would be officially entered into the record. But ultimately, at the end of the day, we all knew what the vote was going to be. And the vote was going to be that Congress was going to affirm the results of the Electoral College. His supporters didn't realize that. They really did think that they could overturn the results of the election. I think they thought that by going to the Capitol, that would be a show of force that could convince Vice President Pence that he could do something other than declare the vote that was going to happen. He was there pretty much in his role as a presiding officer. And then if people didn't do what they wanted them to do, then we saw them decide that they would kind of, take it over by force. And if anybody thought that, President Trump's words were idle, or that the contestation of facts had no consequence, yesterday was the rude awakening that was never true, and that words matter and that symbolic actions matter.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Emory University political scientist Andra Gillespie, and she is helping us make sense of what unfolded at the Capitol yesterday as Congress has formally tallied the Electoral College votes, giving Joe Biden the victory. You can join in with your thoughts, 800-642-1234. There's a group of people who can't accept President Trump's loss. Biden, his task must be to put the pieces back together.
The words of a president matter, no matter how good or bad that president is. At their best, the words of a president can inspire. At their worst, they can incite.
How does Biden begin to do that?
I think he's probably going to do what he'd already planned on doing. And I think the big question from this is whether or not we're going to see a shift in public opinion. We don't know yet, but hopefully by the end of the week, there'll be some survey data that will give us a sense. of what's going on. But, you know, the first thing that he wanted to do was to present an alternative model of leadership, you know, one that is inclusive, one that doesn't micromanage and seek to make everything about a cult of personality, one that seems to be data-driven. So not just with respect to the COVID response, but, you know, also just taking the advice of advisors who have a cultivated expertise and listening to them. And then, you know, figuring out where there are places where one can find common ground and trying to see if you could, you know, exploit those relationships, you know, particularly to model better behavior than what we've seen in the previous administration. It's going to be challenging, and there's still going to be resistance based on what we saw yesterday. You know, I can't guarantee that there's going to be success, but there really isn't any other way to address this and to move forward.
Let's bring in Bill now in Delafield. Bill, how are you reacting?
Well, in my personal opinion, the whole objection process yesterday was more of a dog and pony show than anything, because there wasn't really any debate on what the facts were in the instance of Arizona before everything was interrupted. There was no argument that the judicial branch in Arizona had extended the voting registration time past what the legislature had outlined. And to me, there was no chance that there was going to be a reconsideration of the votes at hand. So, like I said, to me, it was more of a dog and pony show than anything. And
yeah, Andra, the certification of the Electoral College votes, normally this is just a very speedy process and not something that draws so much attention.
You know, it's generally a formality. It is not unusual for objections to be raised. There were objections raised in the 2000 election because of the Bush v. Gore decision. You know, there were objections, you know, raised in 2016 because of Russian interference. But this is largely a formality. By the time the Electoral College votes get to the Capitol, it's pretty much a done deal. People register their dissent in order to raise, you know, objections about things like long lines and other things. I think the big challenge and concern, you know, with this particular election was that people were raising concerns about election integrity and voter fraud that weren't held up in court, that didn't have enough of a factual basis to warrant, a legal examination. But yet President Trump and his allies, one, continue to bring those cases to court, and more importantly, they continue to air those grievances in the court of public opinion, even if they're not true.
It seemed that when Congress returned to their chambers and when they returned to the floor, there was a new tone. It seemed like there was more unity on the floor. Clearly, lawmakers had been rattled. Did that mob change any hearts of Republican lawmakers?
It may have changed some hearts. I mean, we do know that there were some members who had planned on changing or who had planned on objecting in subsequent states who, you know, ended up deciding not to. But then there were the people who doubled down and continued to raise their objections and, you know, voted as such. I think the question is whether or not this was the right venue to air grievances, whether or not it's for political points. I mean, the whole debate about voter fraud, thankfully, in the United States isn't a problem. And so when you're like looking for a solution in search of a problem, right, you know, that kind of reeks of political opportunism. Mm. And in this particular environment, not just what happened yesterday, but also in an environment where we can't ignore voter suppression, we have to ask whether or not this is, you know, nothing more than partisan gamesmanship. And in the case of individuals and their career ambitions, whether or not this is political opportunism.
Yeah.
So we're going to have to, you know, this didn't go away. There's still people who are still convinced that Donald Trump really won the election. And they're just not letting the facts speak to them because the facts point in a very, very different direction.
Emory University political scientist Andra Gillespie, our guide to the mayhem that unfolded on our nation's capital yesterday and what is normally the ceremonial process of Congress certifying the Electoral College vote count. Is our trouble in democracy 800 Is our democracy in trouble? Excuse me, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Congress affirmed President-elect Joe Biden's victory early this morning after pro-Trump rioters stormed the Capitol yesterday. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and Minority Leader Chuck Schumer condemned the mob's assault, and Schumer called out the president in his floor speech.
The president who promoted conspiracy theories that motivated these thugs, the president who exhorted them to come to our nation's capital, egg them on. He hardly ever discourages violence and more often encourages it. This president bears a great deal of the blame. This mob was in good part President Trump's doing.
Matt from Evansville called in to say inciting a riot is a crime and the president needs to be held accountable. Jill from Madison called in to say she's speechless that someone died, and Jill is reflecting on this needless death and is losing faith in community. 800-642-1234 to join in. Let's bring in Steve now in Sun Prairie with thoughts. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. It just makes me angry. I do not condone what happened yesterday, but the tone deaf of the media, even particularly on this show, about the lack of trying to understand where people on the right are coming from. We've seen a year of anti-police protests. Many of them were built on lies upon lies, being actively condoned by Democrats and the media. What happened yesterday was universally condemned by every single conservative. So to not try to understand why people on the right don't trust the media, don't trust our politicians, is just being tone deaf. I don't see Joe Biden leading us anywhere because he does not have the courage to stand up to people in the media who just look at things through a left lens.
Steve, thanks. Andra, Steve is saying the media here plays a role.
I am not sure that I agree with him in this particular moment. And if we want to talk about the protests this summer, one, we saw a much greater police presence at those protests than we saw at this one. And this one was, you know, known to have happened. It was planned. The president invited people on social media to attend this rally. And then it wasn't met with a strong police presence at the U.S. Capitol, which is, you know, how people were able to break into the building and roam the place. And I'm just going to share my perspective as an African-American woman.
Please.
If I and, you know, a group of other black people had stormed the Capitol, we would have been shot on sight. Trust my lived experience on this one and trust the empirical data on this. So, I'm not sure that, you know, that the media was being heavy-handed here. I don't think the media was ignoring what happened. This was a mob that sought to try to overturn the results of an election. I don't know how you don't call that for what it is. And I also don't know how you don't hold President Trump accountable for how his dangerous rhetoric has ginned people up. Now, if we want to talk about making sure that we have, that we present, different points of view on policy preferences, that's fine. But, we're not going to do the false equivalence on saying that, maybe Joe Biden didn't win the election. No, he won, right? Donald Trump and his lawyers have had every opportunity to present credible evidence dozens of times in courts across the country, including at the Supreme Court, to say that there were voting irregularities that could overturn the results of the election, and they didn't stand up in court because they don't have the facts on their side. So, just recycling the same stuff that, is being propounded, in certain media outlets or on social media is not actual factual evidence. And all of those lawyers who get on TV and say one thing but then go in court with no evidence because they know better, right, that should be the sign that you are, in fact, being lied to.
We're talking with Andra Gillespie, Associate Professor of Political Science at Emory University in Atlanta and a political analyst as we look at what has unfolded at the Capitol with your insights at 800-642-1234. Kristen is joining us from Watertown. Hi, Kristen.
Hi there. My whole point is I work in elections And I know that the biggest issue here is if you think there's fraud, you should have addressed it before the election, not after the election, because once votes are tallied, once that vote goes, that ballot goes into that machine, you can't pull that ballot back out or say, well, that's my ballot or that's your ballot. If you think that, like, indefinitely confined, if you have 1,000 indefinitely confined that you think are fraudulently made because they weren't indefinitely confined, you're just going to take out 1,000 ballots, not the 1,000 ballots of those indefinitely confined. It's just 1,000 ballots, and it can go either way. So the whole point of voter fraud consists of somebody who puts in two ballots in the machine, who devises a plan to request two ballots and votes two ballots. That's fraud. Just because you say you're indefinitely confined and you're really not, that's bad voter behavior. But it truly doesn't have anything to do with voter fraud. So the instances of voter fraud are so minuscule because you've got good election workers and you've got good clerk's offices across, you know, the country. And I can speak to Wisconsin. But I trust that the people across the whole United States who work in elections are doing it for the right purpose, because if they don't, they shouldn't be in office if they're not trying to help.
Doing it for the public good. And Kristen's saying, Andra, that these election, you know, these issues should have been cleared up before the election, before the ballots were counted.
You know, I think I want to thank her for her service, and I agree with her perspective. One of the things that's interesting is you can do some retrospective analysis to make sure that things were conducted properly. In my own state of Georgia, which is another state where the vote was going to be contested yesterday, aside from the fact that the presidential vote got counted three times, the original vote, the audit to make sure that the machines were actually counting the votes. And what we found, and people were concerned about this at the beginning of last year, whether or not this was going to work, was that the machines were accurate. So the optical scan vote, which is the official vote tally or the initial vote tally, and then what happened with the paper recount sort of, you know, aligned with one another. They found problems of, you know, certain disks not being uploaded properly. And, you know, when those votes were found, they were counted and added to the total. And then there was another recount, you know, that was automatically triggered by the close margin in the election. So, like, that integrity counted. They've even gone after the fact. My Secretary of State, you know, did an audit of one of the larger counties where they looked at the signatures to make sure that the signatures on the absentee ballots matched the voter registration signatures. And they found that the signature match process was 99.9% accurate. So, you know, and this is the evidence that President Trump was disputing on that phone call that you may have heard about over the weekend, where my Republican Secretary of State had to explain to him every story that you've heard, every rumor that you've heard, we've looked at, and we don't find evidence to substantiate the claims that that you're making. And President Trump just didn't want to accept it.
You know, the violence in D.C. overshadowed your state. The Democrats win in Georgia in the Senate runoffs, and I'm thinking about Georgia's first black senator elect now, the Reverend Raphael Warnock, and I'm thinking about he wrote about Dr. Martin Luther King in his tweet yesterday, ending his tweet with these words: "Let each of us try to be a light to see our country out of this dark moment." What do you make about him coming into office?
So, you know, this is certainly a watershed moment in the state, but it's also not a surprising watershed moment. So over the course of the campaign, Reverend Warnock he talked about race, you know, he didn't shy away from it, and he also was forced to because of the racial attacks against him from Senator Kelly Loeffler. But we didn't talk about the historic first nature of his candidacy. And I think that's in part because people in Georgia have now become accustomed to seeing African-Americans run for high-level offices. So, one, it's something that has happened plenty of times before in the state.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not unusual in a state where the black population is 30%. But we also know that blacks are capable and very competitive political candidates. I think Stacey Abrams did a lot to dispel the notion that blacks couldn't be competitive candidates for statewide office. And so by the time Raphael Warnock, you know, makes it to the runoff election, you know, we weren't surprised, and we also knew that he was going to be a very, very competitive candidate for office. You know, we knew the margin was going to be close. We didn't know exactly who was going to win.
And when we're looking at, you know, why he and John Ossoff won, you know, there are a couple of things that we're looking at. We knew in the early vote that blacks actually made up a slightly larger share of the electorate than their registration numbers would have suggested. So high black turnout is one of the reasons why he was able to win. We're looking at strong turnout in the Metro Atlanta counties, which are now Democratic. And then we're looking at lower turnout in some of the Republican areas.
Andra, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Andra Gillespie is an associate professor of political science at Emory University and a political analyst. Coming up, we talk to the attorney for the family of Jacob Blake, who was shot and paralyzed by a Kenosha police officer last summer. That is after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We are talking with a lawyer for Jacob Blake's family here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. The Kenosha County District Attorney said Tuesday that the white police officer who shot 29-year-old Jacob Blake last summer 7 times in the back will not be charged. Outrage spread after the August shooting. Protesters and counter-protesters swept into Kenosha in the days that followed, seeking racial justice in the wake of the deaths of George Floyd, of Breonna Taylor, and other black Americans in police encounters. How do you feel about the prosecution not bringing charges? Did you join protests? 800-642-1234. Attorney B. Ivory Lamar is representing Blake's family. B. Ivory, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate. Happy to be here.
How do you feel about this decision in light of what you see going on in America right now?
Kate, we're immensely disappointed about the decision that the Kenosha District Attorney made in regards to the Jacob Blake shooting. We believe that there was more than sufficient basis to find probable cause to charge the officer. And I think this is another example of time after time where officers commit these acts and are not held accountable.
What is the Blake family reaction to the DA's decision? How did they prepare for this?
You know, it's sorry to say that, you know, as we just enter into 2021, that while the Blake family remained optimistic that just this would be one of the exceptions that we would actually get justice or an officer would be held accountable, I have to say that it's not surprised. They're not necessarily surprised by the decision, not because the case didn't warrant the facts to bring the charges, but just we believe that there's, and I've said this time and time again, I believe that there's three different justice systems in America. I believe there's one for black and brown people, there's one for police officers, and then there's another for the rest of America. And unfortunately, you know, this was just the outcome that has become all too common.
This was a narrow decision. We heard from the district attorney, Michael Gravely. What more evidence was needed here?
You know, and that's our thing. You know, when the district attorney is to evaluate cases to determine whether probable cause exists, that a reasonable person could determine that probable cause exists that a crime was committed. It's simple as that. It's a very minimal standard. This is not trial. This is not a circumstance where we weigh evidence at this point. I mean, you do have to have a good faith basis to bring those charges, which I think that the outstanding presence of the protesters across the country more than established that there's a reasonable basis to determine that a crime was committed. So I believe that it's a great deprivation of the constitutional rights of America to not have the opportunity to be able to cast judgment. I mean, the family is not saying, you know, we will take the will of the people. The evidence should be put before the public, and the public should have the opportunity to weigh that evidence. What we've seen with the deliverance of District Attorney Michael Gravely's statement along with Noble Ray, it seemed to be a defense argument, a defense closing argument. It didn't seem like a prosecutor. It seemed like they had so many reasons and they took over 4 months to come up with a basis to not you know, apply probable cause as they do in other instances.
In the district attorney's explanation, he mentions a knife that Jacob Blake was holding, saying Blake had the knife open and out. What do you know about the knife?
First of all, I believe that America has seen some 20 seconds of the video. We've seen where Jacob Blake was walking around the vehicle, and at not one specific time in that video can I point to a knife being open or him making any type of forward action against the officer. You know, myself and co-counsel Ben Crump and Patrick Selvey, we've had that video reviewed on numerous occasions by forensic experts and so forth. And there's not one time that we can point to where that happened. I think that there would not be such a large outcry in our country for the Jacob Blake case if that was evident. And I think that this is just another example of, you know, looking to treat African Americans differently when it comes to justice. Again, if they feel that it was open, let the public decide that. That's a defense attorney to find that. But I don't think that's evident based off of what we've seen.
We're talking with B'Ivory Lamar, the attorney for the family of Jacob Blake, who was shot in the back by a Kenosha police officer in August. Your thoughts on this? 800-642-1234. Christy is with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Christy.
Hi.
Hi. What would you like to say about this case?
I would like to say that I think this is disgraceful, that first of all, I'm an older white lady. I think this is disgraceful. That no way did this officer feel threatened at any time he was shooting this man in the back.
Christy, thank you for the call. And it sounds as if Christy is supportive here that she didn't see an officer being threatened. This officer was not wearing a body cam. We're relying on this video that went viral on social media. B'Ivory, what is the significance of not wearing a body camera in the situation?
You know, I think that in this specific situation, I think the fact that the officer didn't have a body cam is not as material because of the fact that we were able to have it captured by independent witness. And I think that we can see the material parts. We see within a 20-second video, you know, Jacob walking around and getting shot seven times. And I think that the video is also very clear that there was not a knife pointed. And the possession of a knife is not illegal in the state of Wisconsin. Knives are used for a variety of different purposes. And there is no basis to deny Jacob for his opportunity to carry a knife just like any other American. So the presence of a knife does not warrant getting shot seven times. What is also interesting is that in the 2-hour explanation for a 20-second video, which America can see, the district attorney and Noble Ray both opined that, oh, well, they were asked, was it excessive to have seven shots? Why could one shot, if you did feel that there was an imminent threat, why would one shot not be sufficient? And their response was, oh, well, we're just, you know, we're trying to just shoot until the danger doesn't exist anymore. I think that's preposterous. I think this is a clear example of excessive force. And I think that members of a jury should be able to make that determination. If they feel like the officer acted objectively, they can have their experts opine during trial, not at this early juncture of the case.
Let's bring in Rosa now in Waterford. Rosa, hi. What are your thoughts?
Good morning. This has nothing to do with race. If I did exactly what Blake did, I would have been shot in the back as well. The 20-second video does not give you the whole picture. If you actually, I had the opportunity to listen to the chief of police, Kenosha, and he did a fabulous job explaining exactly what happened. Blake refused to listen to the police officers when he was told to stop, raise his hands, refused. He did not just walk around his car. What he did is he reached into his car, and that's when the police officers thought he was reaching in for a gun. And that is why the police officer shot. It was heightened emotions. Blake refused to listen. And if I had done the same thing Blake would have done, I would have been shot in the back seven times, eight times, probably even more. Who knows? Heightened emotions, things happen like that. That's the bottom line.
B'Ivory, go ahead.
Sure. I think that statement is misguided for several reasons. First of all, in the state of Wisconsin, obstruction, failing to listen to an officer's order, is a misdemeanor in the state of Wisconsin. It's punishable by a sentence up to 9 months in jail and a fine not to exceed $10,000. You don't get shot in the back seven times for not following an officer's commands. Secondly, in order for an officer to determine, the standard is what's called an imminent threat. Imminent threat is the standard. In order to have an imminent threat, you have to have an articulable basis to be able to determine that there is a threat that's forthcoming. Foremost, there has to be, so for example, if Jacob did reach into his vehicle, and first I want to point out that's a contradiction. The officer is saying that Jacob had the knife on him at the time he was walking to the vehicle. Now, if the knife was inside the vehicle, how would the officer even know that there was a knife inside? I mean, that's a clear contradiction in itself. But what's most important is that Jacob never turned toward the officer. You never see in the video where it's extended. You never see any forward motion whatsoever. And again, this is an argument that should be made before a jury, not at this early stage. African Americans are not getting the same deference when they're charged with a crime. They're just charged. If the evidence bores out later that, oh, you know, we don't have sufficient basis, they either reduce the charges or they dismiss the case. It should be the same standard that police officers should be subjected to.
Let's bring in Diane now in Madison with thoughts. Diane, go ahead.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to comment and say that I don't find or see how any case that any police officer who is trained would feel as though they were threatened when somebody is walking away from them and that they shoot them seven times in the back. That just does not make sense to me that somebody, again, who's a law officer, knows what they're supposed to be doing, feels threatened, especially when they have backup. I just find that this is a very sad situation, and I feel that it is a racist situation. Thank you.
Diane, thank you for the call as we talk with B. Ivory Lamar, an attorney for Jacob Blake's family. Have you taken part in the protests and civil unrest in Kenosha in response to the shooting of Jacob Blake? Do you think the officer who shot Blake should be fired or face federal criminal charges? Did you watch the Kenosha DA's announcement Tuesday? What did you take away? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with B. Ivory Lamar here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Thanks for being here. Let's get back to our conversation with attorney B. Ivory Lamar, who's representing Jacob Blake's family. Jacob Blake, who is black, was left paralyzed after a white Kenosha police officer shot him on August 23rd. The shooting was captured in a video that we've been talking about, and it rapidly spread, put Kenosha at the heart of the protest movement over police brutality and racial injustice. The Kenosha County DA's office announced this week it would not prosecute the officer who shot Blake last summer. B. Ivory Lamar is with us for 10 more minutes. Let's bring in James now in Ripon. Hi, James. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I would just like to say that I know civilian police force and military police force are much different, but when I was in the security forces in the Air Force, we were taught how to properly use deadly force. And then from what I saw in the very short clip that got shared around Twitter, Facebook, all social media platforms, there should be no reason why a man should be shot seven times in the back and killed when there is, from what we have seen, no evidence of the man trying to harm the officer.
James, the officer was not properly trained?
I could argue that he possibly wasn't. I don't know the officer. I don't know how the police academy is for people going into the Kenosha police force. But I, at least from my perspective, I think there needs to be a better training regime for civilian officers.
James, thanks for that. B. Ivory, James is saying there should be a better training on how these officers go about these encounters.
Yes, I would definitely agree with that. I think that it also begs the question, though, however, whether training was the issue, or do we just have a double standard in America? I think that African Americans are disproportionately affected in these circumstances. And I think that if we look at Exhibit A, which is yesterday's circumstance at the Capitol, yesterday posed a very clear example of where officers are put in an imminent danger. They're essentially running from crowds. And we don't see any of those individuals being, you know, shot seven times, or it would be a bloodbath at the Capitol yesterday if the same standard applied as it did in the Jacob Blake case. That is what our issue is. I mean, that's what the larger conversation that America has to have in these circumstances. So is training an issue? It could be, but it can also just be racial bias training that's also needed in these circumstances.
Let's bring in Karen in Stevens Point. Karen, hi, what would you like to add?
Hi, I just kind of have a comment question. I'm very concerned about his family, his children who, you know, saw the shots, and his wife. And since he's, you know, paralyzed partially now, he can't earn any money for the family. So I'm wondering if there's any way they can legally file for financial aid because of this to cover for his medical expenses or for the children or to help them get by. Or is it a loss just like the case?
Wow. Well, I appreciate that that question. I would say that there is civil remedies that we do intend to pursue for Jacob Blake. Part of what we've been doing thus far is just investigating and waiting on the investigation of the Department of Justice to conclude, so that when we do move forward, we have a very strong and adequate basis to understand all the material facts as it relates. But we are definitely in preparation for bringing a civil case, which will help address a lot of those shortcomings, the loss of income, his lost enjoyment of life, the emotional distress, again, for the children who was present when this circumstance, when this event unfolded. So, yes, we definitely have remedies available. And I will say that the fight is not over. We're very disappointed by the decision, but we would definitely be very aggressive in moving forward.
After Blake was shot, we saw the nights of protest, the civil unrest in Kenosha. We saw Kyle Rittenhouse shooting three people, killing two people, seriously injuring the third. Is there any overlap between the Rittenhouse shootings and the upcoming trial and the Jacob Blake case?
Well, I think that it definitely poses two different scenarios and two different outcomes. You know, obviously, I think that, you know, I'm not sure how the state agencies and are looking at how these two cases align. I think there's definitely an overlap in, as it relates to how a person who's simply walking away with no weapon in his hand, making any type of intentional movement, was treated, which he left paralyzed, and an individual who went in is alleged to have murdered, you know, two individuals who were just protesting. So I think there's definitely some overlap as to how we look at these issues. But again, these are social issues that we just need to resolve as a country and as a whole.
Let's bring in Jason in Adams Friendship. Jason, hi.
Yes, I am.
Hi, go ahead, Jason.
Yeah, I just, you know, I've been listening to this all morning for a while here on my drive to work, and I just don't understand why we only talk about this 20-second video. Why don't we hear anything about what happened before that? You know, why, at what point does the warrant for a third-degree sexual assault come into play, that they knew that they were going there and they were going to be arresting this person? He knew that. He walked away from them. You know, at what point do we get past, and this is what this is all about. It's about the racism. That's what these lawyers, the defense lawyers, are bringing up with their criminal suit, that this is about racism. And that's what these riots are all about. At what point do we all just stop and say, you know what, the racism goes both ways? Mr. Crump and the lawyers, they're in every picture of every shooting that has happened, because they make it about them. They don't make it about anything other than them.
Okay, Jason, I'm going to pause there. And going back to Jason's initial question, what happened earlier in the day between Jacob Blake and others that led to police being called?
Sure. In response to Jason's comments, I first want to make clear that any sexual assault allegations or charges have been dismissed. It's been dismissed. So they're not even relative to what happened with within this 20-second video. The 20-second video is material because normally in these type of circumstances, there's always a justification for the police officer's actions. There's always a justification. They always try to assassinate the character of the victim. And it's not material whatsoever. What is material is what the officer did when Jacob was walking around, and what led to him decide to try to employ deadly force. That's the only thing that's material. What happened before that, he could have robbed a bank. He could have tried to climb up the Capitol. He could have done all these different things, and it's not material. What's material is what led up to the choice to exercise deadly force. So that's why the 20-second video is really all that's necessary for us to make a determination whether probable cause existed.
What reforms do you want to see?
Well, I think that I believe that every police department in America needs to have body cams so that there's accountability. We don't want to continue to just hear narratives that are put out by the police officers or the unions. We want to be able to see. And that's the only reason why we're even having this conversation today, is because there was an independent video that we could collaborate what actually did occur on August 23rd. So that's number one. The second thing is that I believe that officers should live in the areas in which they police. I think there should be incentives for that to happen. I think that when you have officers that live in those areas that they police in, they understand the culture. There's less opportunity or probability for them to be intimidated or feel not used to the racial norms. And I think it also ensures confidence in that community and that officer as well. So I think those are two of the main things that I would like to see. And number three, I think that there should not be three justice systems. If probable cause is good for a black or brown person to shoot someone 7 times and he's bound over for trial, an officer should be subjected to the same thing.
How is Jacob Blake doing today?
You know, Jacob Blake's recovery is, you know, he'll never be the Jacob Blake that he was once before. You know, he'll never walk again. He's lost use of all his bodily functions from his waist down. You know, I would say that he tries to maintain to be in good spirits. You know, he's happy to be here. Obviously, many people who have been shot 7 times are not here to still be around their family and you know, be able to talk about it. You know, so these are, you know, it's a tough road and it's an unfortunate circumstance. But I think Jacob is, you know, he's doing his best despite the circumstance.
B. Ivory, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kate, for having me.
B. Ivory Lamar is the attorney for the family of Jacob Blake, who was shot in the back by a Kenosha police officer in August. Just ahead, we'll discuss how medical misinformation and myths spread and why some are hesitant to take the COVID vaccine. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.